From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage.
The South Dakota primary is Tuesday, June 2nd, and in this podcast, we will be introducing you to a number of candidates you'll see on the ballot. First, we hear from Senator Mike Rounds, who joined Lori for a discussion ahead of the primary.
Senator Rounds, thank you for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate the chance to visit with you today.
This is a different kind of campaign in a very different kind of time in American history. So I want to start with the federal COVID-19 response and specifically the payroll protection program. You've said that nearly $1.8 billion has been issued for South Dakota businesses, but we also have the highest unemployment record we've ever had. 47,000 South Dakotans have applied for benefits since mid-March. Talk about the federal response and the federal policy. Did unemployment, conflict with PPP? PPP was supposed to keep people off unemployment. Was it not as effective as you would have liked it to have been? Put that in perspective for us.
No, you bring up a really good point, Lori. There were two portions of it. Well, there were really three portions of direct assistance that were provided by the CARES Act. The first part, which is a direct payment to individuals with less than $75,000 in income the previous year, that was important just for people that had no place else to go to try to get by a tough time. Second of all was the PPP, the Payroll Protection Plan. And as the Secretary of the Treasury has said, it was designed to keep payrolls intact along with benefits. And we thought we were really moving in the right direction and keeping as many people as possible connected with their employers so that we could bounce back and reopen as quickly as possible. Then we also have, and all of the unemployment processes are run through the state systems. And unfortunately, part of what we tried to put in was an enhancement to the unemployment benefits that would have been up to and equal to what they would have been paid if they were working. But our Democrat colleagues said it had to be $600 additional per week across the board, $2,400 per month, because the state systems they thought would be inundated if we allowed them to try to measure it to bring it up only to what a person was paid. So in essence, there's a number of individuals who applied for unemployment who are getting paid more now than what they would at their regular job. Those benefits, though, are temporary. They'll go for about 12 weeks or so here. And in July, most of those will, by about July 31st, most of those enhanced benefits will end. And those individuals will then be back in looking to get reemployed with their employer. We had hoped that, we could accelerate that so that employees would come back to work earlier. So, yeah, there was a conflict there. We actually had a live vote on the Senate floor. Republicans voted in favor of taking the $600 and modifying it to be just up to what they were being paid before. Our Democrat colleague says, no, we're going to add the full $600 in. And it has caused some problems. But nonetheless, between the two, we've been able to get a lot of money back out in a very, very short period of time for the federal government. It has not been without its problems. I mean, anytime you're talking about a brand new program and getting it out literally billions of dollars in a very short period of time, you are going to have some hangups, and we did have some. The SBA's software program did not work as well, but I can also tell you we had local lenders, loan officers in multiple small banks throughout South Dakota that worked overtime, literally 24/7, over weekends to get out as much of the money as possible. We're going to have some additional hangups because we set that money up under the PPP so that basically all of that money, if it was used properly, could be forgiven. It changed from a loan into a grant if 75% or more of the money went to payroll. Now we're going to have a challenge with folks trying to make sure that they actually complied with that. We need to make some simplifications on that. We're going to be working on that. We've already started working on it to make sure that our friendly bureaucrats in the SBA and the Treasury don't make it more complicated than what it already is.
When Governor Kristi Noem was on the program here recently, we asked about some of the things she thought were early successes with the state response to COVID-19 and some things that she, in retrospect, wishes had gone differently. And she mentioned the healthcare system working together in the state, you know, Vera, Sanford, and Monument, and you know the challenges of that happening. And one of the disappointments or the things you thought could have gone better is, you know, early access to testing kits. It just took a while for that to get up and running, and she thought that made a difference. I want to ask you the same question, and that is, what would earlier action have saved lives across the country from a federal response? Are there other things that, in retrospect, you look back and say, if we had done this a little bit differently, we would have had a better result?
We started receiving briefings, private briefings, but not classified briefings way back in January about what was going on in China. I will give President Trump a lot of credit for shutting down incoming traffic from China as soon as he did. That made a huge difference. If we could have done it earlier than what we did, if we would have known what was going on in China earlier, that could have saved more lives across the entire world. But I give him a lot of credit for that. I did ask, and in fact, I actually sent a letter to the vice president and the president requesting earlier that they fully open up the Federal Emergency Management Center on a 24-hour basis earlier than what they did. I thought that could have been done more quickly to get the logistics involved. And I think that would have allowed us to move necessary equipment around perhaps more quickly than what it already was. And I would agree with the governor's assessment that we don't have enough tests even today. And in fact, I think it's going to be, you know, late August, early September before the number of tests that are reliable will be out and into the public. That is something that we need to learn from this pandemic and not happen again. And that is a better plan for getting testing set up, organized, and in. In many cases, we had systems in place to do the testing, but we didn't have enough material to do the testing. And in some cases, the tests that were issued would take 3 and 4 days to get results. Well, that's a long time to wait to find out whether or not somebody's tested positive. So we need better testing. And then the other piece of this that, you know, therapeutics in this particular case have been a long time in coming. And we've got to do a better job of that. Pharmaceuticals and so forth. I think we need to start talking about strategically producing more of them in the United States. And some people will say, well, that's going to add some cost. And they may be right. But I think in terms of our national defense and our national strategy, we have to recognize that if we want people to be safe, a lot of these industries and professions, we need to have them come back into the United States again just for our own defensive purposes. A lot of it's been moved over into other countries. Some of them are not our friends. China is a very good example. We try to do business with them. They cheat on their business deals. And when it comes to national defense, we have identified since 2017 that they are our near peer competitor on a military basis. And so we've got to be very careful and refocus on the great powers competition again. We've started on it, but this is one more educational opportunity for the people in this country to recognize that China really, at this stage of the game, is not our friend, and we have to be prepared for that.
One of the other things you've been talking about lately, and SDPB is doing a week-long spotlight on next week, is about the supply chain weaknesses in our food. Cattle producers, pork producers in South Dakota have been hit hard. There were, you know, funnels, and we've been talking about packer concentration. This is a conversation that's been a long time coming. Many people were not surprised. Others were shocked at the revelations that COVID-19 made them notice for the first time about how our food supply chain works, especially regarding meat products. What needs to be done next, and why is it different now? Because one of the concerns is we're just going to end up back where we were. The plants will reopen, and it will be business as usual. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think we can go back to business as usual. We need consumers to recognize that this is in their better interest to know what the where their food comes from, how secure it is, and the availability of it in the times of another national emergency. The packer concentration is a legitimate concern for our producers in South Dakota. Right now, the bigger problem, we've got about more than 80% of the market is controlled by four packers. Two of those packers are actually controlled by international or non-U.S. organizations, and they're bringing in beef from other countries such as Brazil. And part of it is they own a lot of that beef when they bring it in. And so the packer concentration is one part of it. The vertical integration where it is controlled by the packer to begin with. So if the prices start to go up on beef in the United States, they simply bring in more of their own beef and drop the price back down again as they refuse to participate in that cash market at your local barns. So that's part of the issue here. And for me, it's the reason why back in March, I sent a letter to the Justice Department saying enough is enough. Look, the market is broken. You need to do an investigation as to whether or not these packers are in violation of the antitrust laws that have been in place. And so, first of all, if you're I was joined at that time by three different senators on the same letter. Now we've got over 18 senators that we've joined together on another letter since then asking for the same thing. The president has now joined on asking for this investigation, whether or not the packers have been involved in antitrust activity. And furthermore, my first letter said if they have not been involved in it, if the laws have not been violated, then there's something wrong with the laws. And we have to go back in and fix the laws because the market is broken. And if we don't fix it, we're going to have producers that are going to go broke. And what we lose then is the ability to produce our own food in the United States, and we will be relying on food coming in from outside sources. We can't let that happen. That has got to be recognized. The other piece on this is it's these producers, in order to survive, they've got to get a fair price on their products all the way up and down the food chain. And so when you start talking about that, it means that you've got to be able to identify what a fair price is on an open market. That's the reason why we've also asked, particularly in the beef trade, that we have at least 50% of the price being established for any other formula activity to be based on a fair cash basis. But it starts with, you know, getting the antitrust laws enforced or fixing the antitrust laws. And the other piece on this that I've hit right away is our own Department of Agriculture actually has a rule in place that allows the packers to bring in beef from other countries and then reprocess it. And if they reprocess it, they get to call it a product of the USA. That's wrong. That's false advertising. That should be fixed immediately. So we included the Beef Integrity Act to put pressure on the Department of Ag to change that rule right now, so that when an American consumer goes to the meat cooler and looks at something and it says product of the USA, they know it really is a product of the USA and not just repackaged and coming in from another country.
You're just tuning in. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. South Dakota's primary is on Tuesday, June 2nd, and he faces Republican challenger Skyler Borglum on that primary ticket. Senator Rounds, before I let you go, I think I would be remiss in not asking you about people protesting across the nation today after Tuesday's killing of George Floyd. The mayor of Minneapolis has now called for the arrest of the police officer who placed his knee on Floyd's neck as Floyd pleaded for his life. President Donald Trump has called for the FBI and the Department of Justice to expedite that investigation into the incident. But the Minneapolis Police Department has been the subject of investigation before. Is it a detailed investigation into this killing enough? What more do you think needs to be done?
I saw yesterday morning, I saw pictures, the movie, the recording of what went on, and I was sick to my stomach. I could not believe that a law enforcement officer would use that type of force over that extended period of time on an individual who was clearly in distress. absolutely, this is wrong. It has to be pursued. I was in disbelief as I watched what was going on. A full investigation absolutely has to be done, and they need, as soon as possible, to bring out and explain either why they are not bringing charges, or they need to bring charges and get to the bottom of this. And so in this particular instance, the individuals that were involved in this absolutely have to be brought to justice, and they have to be brought in and be accountable for the actions that killed this individual. And it just, I was sick to my stomach. I'm still frustrated by it and angered by what we saw. And a full investigation, it needs to be done immediately. My heart just went out to the individual. You put yourself in that position and you wondered, if we were there actually on the spot, would any of us have taken it upon ourselves to literally walk in and interfere with which was clearly a police action and say, in this particular case, this law enforcement officer is above and beyond and needs to be accountable immediately to save a life. I very seldom do you look at one of these and feel as strongly as what we saw on this particular one. Just thinking about it right now makes me sick to my stomach, and I feel like most of the people in the country do. This organization and these individuals need to be held accountable now.
Senator Mike Rounds, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. Bye-bye.
Now, Rounds does not go unchallenged this year. Skylar Borglum is a South Dakota representative running against Senator Rounds, and she joined Lori to discuss why she believes she is the right person for the job.
She's a professional engineer and business leader who also holds a master's degree in theology. She lives in Rapid City, and she joins us today on the phone. Skylar Borglum, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Lori. It's my pleasure.
This has been an interesting, to say the least, time to run a campaign in South Dakota with limitations on gatherings and parades or Lincoln dinners and things like that. But you've also turned to social media pretty effectively to try to take questions from people and have a presence. Tell us a little bit about your campaign strategy and how it has incorporated social media and pivoted as well to a new way of reaching voters.
Certainly. One of the aspects of my campaign that I have tried to communicate to my followers and those who are just getting to know me is that in these times, we have to be adaptable, and we cannot run a campaign as a checklist like they were run back in the day. We simply are moving too fast. There are too many changes happening, and we have access to technology and social media in a way that even 2 years ago, it wasn't as extensive as we have right now. So on the one hand, certainly the best part of campaigning is getting out and meeting people face to face, literally shaking their hands, getting them to look me in the eye and ask me the hard question person to person. But since that really wasn't an option for these last 8 to 12 weeks, what we did instead was put me on Facebook Live just about every single night. And South Dakotans have had the opportunity to type their questions in the comment bar. So when they see me on Facebook Live, I answer the questions as they come in. And this has been there has been such a terrific response to this. I do it formally on Thursday evenings called Borglum Answers South Dakota, and then it just started picking up speed, so no matter when I was on Facebook doing a live video, anybody who had a question or a comment or wanted to know something about me could really just type it in, and I'd answer it as we went. The best part to me about that is it gives South Dakota direct access to the candidate who wants to be their United States Senator, and I believe in transparency. I believe in accessibility, And these Facebook Lives and these social media events that I've done, they're raw. They're unedited, and people have the chance to get to know me personally, and other people have the benefit of that. So the pivot really worked in our favor as a way to get the word out as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Did you notice themes emerging from South Dakotans? Were there topics that they came back to again and again that have really changed or informed your focus as a candidate?
I did. South Dakotans are remarkable in their consistency for what they worry about. They worry about America, they worry about their neighbors, and they worry about their families. And right now, what is coming across loud and clear is their concern about food security. Now, South Coast may not use that phrase specifically, but what they're asking about is, can our cattle producers stay in business? How can we help them? What's going on in the hog farming community? How can we support our agricultural community? How can we make sure that food is getting from the farms and the producers to the consumers as efficiently as possible? And then, of course, with COVID-19 erupting like it did, COVID-19 didn't cause any of these problems, but it really shone a bright light on the fractures in our food security vulnerability. And that brought to light Mr. Rounds' EB-5 program that he's bringing back with Senate Bill number 2778. Which invites foreign nationals into the United States on a visa for sale program, and it focuses specifically on rural areas. Well, Lori, in our rural areas, what do? We produce food. So here we have a situation where Americans cannot get the food that's being grown and produced right here, and we know that it's being shipped already through Smithfield back to China. They quadrupled their shipments of pork back to China at the same time that food on American shelves had dropped by 30%. So my question is, why did Mike Rounds bring this program back when we already have deep fractures in our food system? We need to put food production and processing back in the hands of Americans. I feel very, very strongly about this. I wouldn't outsource our military to Russia. I wouldn't outsource or sell our cybersecurity to North Korea. So why are we selling ag land and ag development to China, who already has a food shortage and is going around the planet right now actively looking for ways to feed its population?
When we talked with congressional leaders about COVID-19 and even just watching press conferences, from the governor or from the president in the White House over the last, several weeks and months, everything from Q-tips being, the wooden part of the Q-tip being manufactured in Italy to pharmaceuticals, which are manufactured in other companies. And a lot of people are rethinking how globalization works and what happens in a crisis. Are we thinking broadly about it regarding food? And I want to talk to you about possible solutions, because this is a complicated problem that, as you said, COVID-19 didn't start it. It shone a light on it. So let's say voters send you to Washington. Where do you begin with that issue? What do you think are core things to address?
The first thing that we need to address is, what do we consider essential for our national security? We know that we need ample and affordable food. We know that we need a strong military defense. We know that we have everyday supplies Americans rely on. And we know that certainly within that, we have the medical community who needs to have access to consistent supplies and products. So my recommendation for this would be, put together a plan of what we would consider essential for national security in the event that the globe shuts down again like we just saw it do. And Lori, I would argue that this isn't going to be an if situation, this is going to be a when situation. So let's take every possible learning that we can from COVID-19, the things we did well, and the things we need to do better on next time, and put it in a plan. And then going forward, we need to decide as a country, what do we want to require states in South Dakota? Or South Dakota. You can tell how in love with South Dakota I am. I want everything here in the United States. So for example, in 2013, they had a Senate hearing on whether or not to sell Smith Middle Foods to a Chinese company. Now, you and I know that it's an authoritarian state, which means even if it's a Chinese business, the government, the Chinese government, very much has its fingers in that pie. And what I would argue is we need to walk this back and start finding ways and mechanisms to break up these groups that have been sold off to foreign countries and entities that we have decided are part of our national security platform. And once we decide what those are, we can put into progress or put into process how we want to make those American again, because this is something that I think caught the American people off guard. But I'm holding our lawmakers' feet to the fire on this one. We as lawmakers, whether it's at the state level or the national level, have a responsibility to be looking at unintended consequences. We need to be planning for 30 years out, at least one generation, and we need to decide, who are we there to serve? Are we there to serve our own re-election, or are we there to serve the people who sent us and expect them to make solid long-term decisions?
How do we bring back, and I want to bring it back to South Dakota, because like you, that's often my focus and a lot of voters' focus too, even for our congressional delegation. How do we bring back those local lockers, those local butcher shops, the things that farmers and ranchers and small-town South Dakotans have watched disappear over the years as things have been consolidated? How do you dismantle what exists, continue at scale, but then also provide the diversity that the marketplace really needs to survive?
Certainly. Well, the first thing is there's the Prime Act sitting on the desk of a senator whose name escapes me at the moment, but that needs to get out and pass through the Senate, the House, and be signed by the president, because what that will do is really open the door for smaller meat lockers and custom butcher shops to open back up across the country. We need to take a serious look at the regulation that's been layered and layered and layered upon meat processing facilities and ask, is this necessary? Of course we want a safe product to go out to consumers, but sometimes I think government gets in the habit of just layering on one more regulation or one more rule. And if they aren't necessary, then we need to strip those away. We've had meat lockers in South Dakota who either wanted to expand or build in some of these smaller towns, but it would cost upward of $1 million to get started. Well, there's no way that a small business in Lemon or in Belmont, South Dakota, is going to be able to clear $1 million to stay in business. And so they're either restricted in their growth or they simply give up in the meantime. I think that Wyoming has done an excellent job passing laws making it accessible for ranchers to sell directly to consumers, and Iowa recently did something similar. So that could be done at a state level, and what we could do at the federal level is start incentivizing these small businesses and value-add businesses that can go into these small towns, provide economic opportunity, and serve the food producers. So that would be a major piece of the work I contributed if I were elected on June 2nd.
Do you think the packers are breaking the law? Do you think there are antitrust laws in place that are being violated and need to be enforced? Or do you think that the laws need to be adjusted to deal with packer concentration and its consequences?
My understanding and everything that I've read suggests that the packers have a monopoly. And whether they are deliberately colluding or not, I don't know the answer to that. That, I believe, is what this investigation that the President Trump has called for is all about. And my argument is more broad than that. And it's simply to say, anytime you have four companies who control 80 to 85% of the market, that's a monopoly by any definition. And so whether it's the Packers and Stockyards Act or the Sherman Antitrust Act, I don't care. But we need to break that monopoly up. And if they have been up to financial shenanigans, they need to be held to account. And if it's an unintended consequence of these four companies having a stranglehold on an industry, then no matter. But either way, this needs to be fixed, and it needs to be remedied ASAP.
Do you think there is a role for mandatory country of origin labeling in this conversation? Is there an appetite in it for Washington? How do we move forward with something that seems to be consensus in South Dakota is good for South Dakota ranchers and consumers, but doesn't seem to go anywhere in D.C.?
I think that the mandatory country of origin labeling is something that we should be going forward with, guns blazing. Cattle are in 50 states. All 50 states in the union have a cattle industry, Lori. And if there's one other thing that ties us together besides being Americans, it's our cattle industry. There is no excuse for not having mandatory country of origin labeling. I can tell you where every single truck part on my F-150 comes from. I can tell you where my T-shirts come from and my Kiwis in my refrigerator. So why is it that these two components, beef and pork, why is it that these two are excluded? Well, the WTO had issues with the way the law was being applied, and they wanted those specifics fixed, but they didn't actually have an issue with mandatory country of origin labeling itself. And I've relied on Bill Bullard and RCAP USA for guidance in this area because they are the experts. So we have the appetite in America. We have the appetite in South Dakota. We have the appetite with our cattle industry. And the hang-up is going to be these packers. And here's what's happening. Packers have conditioned United States consumers to pay top dollar for their beef products. And what they're doing is importing cheap beef from third world countries that are not held to the same production standards that United States cattle producers are held to. So the U.S. cattle producers and South Dakota cattle producers, it costs them about $900 a head to produce this meat. They're getting far less than that if they can get a bid at all, which means they're not seeing these spectacular returns. Only the packers are getting all of this money, and they're making money hand over fist. So I think it's the packers who are really hanging on to this money-making machine that they've got. And the people in Congress, whether it's the Senate or the House of Representatives, either haven't educated themselves on these problems or are in line with what the packers are doing. Those are the only two options. And I think that if we can get people to just understand what's going on, American consumers will be outraged at how much they've been paying for foreign beef or not knowing where their beef comes from. And start demanding mandatory country of origin labeling so they know if they want to go out and purchase an American steak or an American piece of meat, that they can get that, and that's what they're paying for.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Skylar Borglum. She is a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. That primary is Tuesday, June 2nd. She is running to unseat U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. And Skylar, before we let you go, I want to talk about the news of the day, because so often our congressional delegates are asked to respond to things that are happening. The death of George Floyd, a Minneapolis man who was killed by a police officer, that video circulated on social media. Four officers were fired. The last time I checked before we started our broadcast, no one had been charged in his death yet. If you were in Congress, and now, of course, protests have erupted in Minneapolis and are starting to spread into other cities as other people protest the death of black people at the hands of police. If you're in Congress and you're asked to issue a statement or make a statement on Twitter or what have you, what do you think would be important for you to say to people?
I think it's important that those of us who are seeking elected office or are in elected office be circumspect about commenting on other states' issues. And certainly this is a tragedy. Nobody wants someone who is being arrested to die in custody. And I think that it's a commentary on the tinderbox race relations that we have across our country right now. I know that the race relations, whether it's with African Americans and whites or Native Americans and whites, we have a long, long way to go. We'd like to think we've made progress. I'm not sure that that's happened.
If you listen to the show often, you've certainly heard from Congressman Dusty Johnson a number of times. Next, we hear from Liz Marty May, who is running against Congressman Dusty Johnson. She's a former state lawmaker, and she runs a cattle operation and the grocery store in Kyle.
Liz Marty May is running against Congressman Dusty Johnson. She's a former state lawmaker. She runs a cow-calf operation and the grocery store in Kyle, South Dakota. She joins us now on the phone. Liz Marty May, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
I want to get into some meat supply issues and some of the things that we've seen exposed by COVID-19 that ranchers really have known for some time. But I want to start with you with something we were just talking about with the Dakota Political Junkies, and that is the challenges of running a campaign against an incumbent right now during the time of social isolation and distancing. Have you found that there are challenges? Has it been business as usual for you on the campaign trail? And how have you adjusted?
It's absolutely, not been business as usual on a campaign trail this season or this primary. It has been super, super challenging and completely outside the box. We've had to really think of other ways to reach our people. I just really I've never experienced anything quite like this, but I've had a good team surrounding me, and it really has been a grassroots movement. I've had so many volunteers. I think we had 83 during the petition process, which was absolutely amazing. Without all those great people working, we wouldn't have been able to have even got the signatures. So I'm just thrilled. We ended up with about double of what we actually needed. So that tells the story about my candidacy and taking a run at an incumbent. So I'm appreciative to all the volunteers. I guess I could say that.
Yeah, when you hear from those volunteers and you hear from donors, you hear from supporters of your campaign, what is inspiring them about your campaign? What has them excited to see your name on the ballot and to see you run against Congressman Johnson?
Well, I think the big issue is I've been in ranching my whole life. My husband and I have a cow-calf operation, and this has been a fight that we've been in for 30-plus years anyway. And, we finally have reached the boiling point where it was either now or never. Somebody had to step up. And we've got to get a voice in D.C. that represents the number one industry in the state of South Dakota. And we need somebody with that experience that understands it. And I feel like I have that experience. I've been in this my whole life. And then on the other side of it, I own a grocery store. I bought the local grocery store 16 years ago in Kyle and brought it up basically from the ground up. I mean, it was basically shut down when we bought it. We didn't have any books, and we were able to turn that place around and make it a successful business. And over the last few months, I've really seen the devastation with the food supply chain, and not being able to get product has just been so challenging, especially when I'm surrounded by cattle. And I usually order about 2,000 pounds of 80-20 or, your cuts like your chucks and arm sirloins, clods, those kind of things, twice a week, which is about 4,000 pounds a week. And the last two trucks, I've received 80 pounds. And so that kind of tells you the tale of the kind of problems we have in specifically in the meat supply chain.
Yeah. How do you explain that problem to other people? Because that was rancher Eliza Blue wrote a column for the New York Times recently and said, you know, we knew this was a problem. We knew how fragile this, as ranchers, we knew how fragile this system was to begin with. For people who are just noticing it for the same time, for the first time, and their awareness has been raised by COVID-19, how do you explain what exactly is happening there that causes that fragility?
Well, I think the easiest way for the consumers to understand it is we have four major packers in the United States that control 85% of the beef processing. And so, and I might add that two of those are foreign-owned. And so when you don't have any competition in the marketplace, this is what happens when, you know, say COVID-19, but this also happened back in August, if you remember the Holcomb fire in Kansas that started in one of the plants, and I think it burned 1,200 square feet, and it absolutely took the cattle market and just tipped it upside down. And so it is so, so fragile, and we've seen this, and we've been worrying about this for years and years and years, and yet, you know, we keep sending people to Washington, I think, that don't understand the industry. You know, we've bought into this big is better. And that is not the case, specifically in the cattle industry and the processing of our beef. You know, it used to be we had all these local lockers. And, you know, Black Hills Pack, for instance, in Rapid City, where a lot of the ranchers were able to use Black Hills Pack for their cull cows and those kind of things. And now we don't have those anymore. And me, specifically, with my grocery store, I have one option, and that is to buy from the four major packers. I cannot buy from my local locker. We do have a few in South Dakota that are USDA inspected. But they're, of course, backed up, and they have their own customers, and so they can't add any more. We need the PRIME Act. It's been on Representative Macy's desk for 2 years. None of the South Dakota delegation has put their name on that or promoted that. That would allow somebody like me to buy from, say, my local locker in Martin, South Dakota. They would be state inspected. They wouldn't have to have the USDA inspection, and the inspection process for the state versus the USDA, there is no difference. It's just a different stamp. And so that is something that I would really, really like to see everybody get behind. So anyway, you know, it's complicated, but it really isn't complicated. We've basically sold ourselves out to four major packers controlling 85% of the market. It's really that simple.
So, you know, you mentioned, you know, bigger is not necessarily better, and that's what we have bought into. Address the issues of scale, though, because when I ask those questions of people on this show, they say that's all fine for, you know, a few consumers who are sourcing from a local farmer. But we're talking about feeding the planet. We're talking about, you know, a much larger scale here. Can we make the changes that that you say need to be made, but do them in a way that continues the scale that we need to feed people and for ranchers to survive?
Well, obviously, what they've put in place, we've seen how fragile it is, and it's not working. So, you know, you can talk about a local scale, like Kyle Grocery, for instance, and me wanting to supply, you know, whether the meat's coming from Nebraska, whether it's coming from Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, I need that option available to me, just as everybody around the United States needs the same option. Right now, we do not have that option. And so, You know, I just don't buy into that. Big, yeah, we need big. But the thing of it is, then you go to your workforce. You've got the workforce problem. Working in a processing plant is hard work. I mean, anybody that's butchered a beef or butchered a hog understands the process. It's not easy. It's hard work. And but these large companies have these huge lines of people, and they've all got, you know, whether they're deboning or whatever they're doing. And if we could move them down to more smaller scales, we wouldn't have had these major shutdowns. We've had these shutdowns because in the meat processing plants, there's so many people on that supply chain line doing what they do. Right now, since COVID-19 started, and this just will give you an idea, we've been losing about, I think we're behind about 140,000 head in slaughter per week since this started. And those are USDA statistics. And so if you look at it today, we are over 1 million head behind slaughter, okay? So if you look at a year out, if this continues, we're going to be 4 million head behind, say, next July at this time. So we've got to make changes, and we've got to make them now. We can't keep going down this road. You know, they talk, well, you know, there's a lot of other commodities that are involved in the trade negotiations. Well, that's true, and I understand that. And but we have to remember, livestock are live animals. We can't hold on to livestock. You know, they get to a certain weight. You know, the packers, they don't want them over that 1,500-pound mark. We've got cattle in right now that are weighing over 1,800 pounds, and the packers, they won't put bids out on them. They're too large. They're too large for their chains, and they don't fit the box. And so the immediate fix, first of all, you need to stop all the imports. We import from 21 different countries from all over the world. You can set up on Highway 85 coming out of North Dakota on 79, and up until about 2 weeks ago, the live trucks coming in to the United States from Canada, it was just one after another. And I have nothing against Canada, but we are in a crisis here, and we have to shut off the imports until we can get caught back up, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Liz Marty May is running for U.S. Congress. Her opponent, Congressman Dusty Johnson, that primary is on June 2nd. Liz, find you on Facebook. Is there a campaign website you want to direct people to find out more? And I appreciate SDPB is going to do a week-long project next week about the meat supply chain, and you'll hear features all next week on that. So I appreciate Liz Marty May spending time on that issue, kind of setting that up so we understand more deeply what the real problems are here in South Dakota. Website for people to go find more information?
Sure, www.lizmayforcongress.com, or you can find us on our Facebook page. And, yeah, I just encourage everybody to go there and check us out. And, you know, if there's anything that you can do for the campaign, and I encourage everybody to vote for me on June 2nd. Let's send somebody out to Washington that has the experience and the knowledge and the background to bring a voice to this number one industry in South Dakota, because I just strongly believe that if things don't turn around in South Dakota and turn around fast, we're going to lose this industry.
We appreciate your time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, be sure to listen to In the Moment this Monday, where you'll be able to hear from Dusty Johnson as well.
The South Dakota court system has had to adjust to the COVID-19 pandemic, and Minnehaha County is home to the largest number of cases. Crystal Johnson is the interim state's attorney for Minnehaha County. She'll be on the ballot Tuesday, and she joined Lori on this Tuesday to talk about the challenges and her office's response.
Crystal, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Lori. It's good to be here.
Tell me about how your office has responded to safety needs at this time. Let's look at the big picture first, and then we'll get into some of the details.
How our office has directly handled the pandemic is we have had to modify our work schedules where we have implemented using technology a lot more when it comes to courtroom appearances. We've utilized Zoom on many occasions to make appearances, so we're able to make appearances from inside our office or inside our home into the courtroom to handle those cases. There's still certainly issues and situations where we need to be into the courthouse, whether a victim is going to be present, if we have to present a case to the grand jury. And so then we try to implement as much of the social distancing, wearing masks if we can, and using those types of things to try to stay safe, to keep ourselves safe. And then we are using Zoom and some of those other technology resources, ITV, to allow victims to also access courtrooms to testify to the grand jury, those types of things, so to limit their exposure as well.
Some, you know, essential work happening. Let's talk about your staff first. Have they been safe? Have you had problems, just inherent challenges like healthcare workers have had? Or has it been going pretty well as far as keeping their health intact? And because you need to keep your workforce working as well, you don't
Correct.
Want those shortages.
No, knock on wood, we have been fortunate to not have much for issues dealing with quarantining and those types of issues. And so we have been open every day since the pandemic started. Our cases have actually increased this month or these last 10 weeks since we've been in the, since the first case has really been announced in South Dakota. And so we've had to be here and handle our job and do our work. We fortunately have been fortunate to not have any major issues that have come through the office, whether dealing with witnesses or employees. One positive employee could certainly take out a bunch of us, which could cripple our workforce. We've had, if it happens to our front staff, to our legal office assistants, myself and a couple of the attorneys have now been trained to open files and do some of their skills. So if it were to happen that we could adjust and readapt and just change some job skills for a little bit to continue doing the work that we need to do.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about challenges of people failing to make it to court. As everything changes and life situations change, failure to appear is an ongoing challenge. Is it worse right now? Are there more cases of that?
Absolutely. The month of April, we sat at about two-thirds non-appearances. So if we had 100 cases scheduled, only about 33 of the people were showing up for court. I think a couple different factors go into play in that. Whether we amended our bond schedule, which allows more people to get out of jail before they go in front of a judge. And so then they would get booked into jail. They would be released from jail with a new court date, and then they're just not showing up for that court date. What sometimes then happens is when law enforcement comes into contact with them and they have that warrant out, they get arrested for that warrant, and then either they are doing something illegal or have something illegal on them, which then causes them to have another case. And so we're getting this backlog of cases because people aren't showing up for court that at some point we're going to have to deal with. Those cases don't get forgotten. They don't go away until we're able to handle them. So at some point, law enforcement in our office is going to have to deal with a backlog of a significant number of cases.
So normally, how does that work? There's a team of, you know, a warrants team that they don't normally go, you know, knock on your door if you have just a failure to appear warrant. Is that going to have to change at some point? I mean, that at some point, it becomes a larger issue.
It certainly does. And I think it's one that we have to sit down and look at with the sheriff to see the best way to handle a backlog of warrants, whether we notify people and allow them to come turn themselves in so we can get the case moving along. We do have a warrant task force comprised of members of our sheriff's office who go out and serve warrants. They typically try to go more serious offenses to less serious offenses, the ones that they are specifically trying to target. But it certainly is an issue that we're going to have to address, and they are going to be very busy when we start being proactive with it again.
Right. Message to people who might have those warrants right now. What's your advice to them to sort of shore those things up now?
What I would advise them to do, because a lot of those warrants are personal recognizance warrants or PR warrants, so it isn't going to cost them anything to get out of jail. And so what I would tell them is now is the time to probably go turn yourself in and get a court appearance. Our courthouse is running. Just because we've had a pandemic, it hasn't shut down. And so your case can still be handled in a timely manner. And now might be a lot easier to get it resolved than pushing it off, because you can't, it isn't going to go away just because you ignore it.
Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit if we can and talk about your time as interim state's attorney, because you have replaced Aaron McGowan, who was investigated and departed under, less than ideal circumstances. That office was under a lot of scrutiny. Your staff was under a lot of pressure and stress before he left, during the investigation and afterwards. Tell us a little bit about how you stepped into that role and worked with the staff to sort of restore not only the public trust, but the confidence internally that this is an office that's doing great work.
I started in this office back in 2005. Back when we still used VCR tapes as evidence. And so I've been here a long time. I left in 2015 to become a judge. In 2018, I came back because this is where I belong. This is where I've always felt a calling to do work. And I've always been a leader in the office. I've always been one where people come to for problems or issues or things they want to talk about. Even before I was appointed as interim state's attorney, that I've just been a familiar face for lots of people, and I've been in the office a long time, so I knew how things worked. And so during last year, it was certainly an uncertain time, but the attorneys in our office and the staff in our office never wavered from doing their jobs. They were here administering justice every single day. The cases didn't suffer. The victims didn't suffer because of it. We're an office of professionals. We're a professional attorney office, which meant that we were able to separate what was going on with Mr. McGowan from our work. And while that certainly caused a stress that our office had to deal with, it wasn't a stress that affected our work or affected our work product. And so when he resigned, I was first appointed by Judge Howman and then hired by the county commission. It was a very natural role for me to step into. During those uncertain times, I was always a voice of reason. I was here for the attorneys, for the staff every day to help work through some of those things. And I think, even though we dealt with that, I think it made us as a group of, as an office, a tighter unit, because we went through something that in the public eye was embarrassing. But we had the opportunity to still do the work that we needed to do. And it made us just kind of close our knit closer together, that we were able to rely on each other a lot more. And so stepping into that role then was a very natural progress for me. I've been here a long time. I've always had ideas on things to do, ways to work this office. I've been involved in major decision making throughout these 13 years that I've been a prosecutor, from homicide cases and rape cases. And so I think it was a natural transition for the office. I think my personality helped lift some of the morale in the office. And I think it was also a very conscious or smooth transition for law enforcement, because I've had a very good working relationship with both the police department and the sheriff's office throughout the whole time that I've worked here.
Minnehaha County State's Attorney Crystal Johnson joining us for a conversation about leadership in times of crisis and the ongoing work of public safety and criminal justice during a difficult time. State's Attorney Johnson, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate it. Hope to talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Lori. Have a good day.
Now, Johnson is on that ballot Tuesday, and she has two challengers to the office. And we met those challengers on Wednesday.
Paul Bangford is a Sioux Falls attorney with 28 years of private and public practice, including both criminal and civil law. He has 87 jury trials as a prosecutor. He was previously a deputy state's attorney for Minnehaha County, and he's currently an assistant city attorney for the city of Sioux Falls. Paul, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, and thank you for inviting me on the show.
I want to start out talking about leadership because, you know, across the, we have a statewide audience here, and across the state, there are many, you know, different people on the primary ballot. This is an office here in Minnehaha County, however, that is, was impacted by the departure of state's attorney Aaron McGowan, and that story made statewide news with his prolonged absences and investigation into his conduct. So let's start, Paul, by talking about leadership coming in during a time of a pandemic, taking over this office and leading these attorneys. Tell me a little bit about how you would approach that challenge, because it's a really important transition right now.
Well, you are correct. It is a big challenge. I mean, the state's attorney's office is crucial to the community, protects the community in terms of its prosecutions. It needs to be fair and just to everyone who makes contact with it. The office not only handles criminal prosecutions, but juvenile delinquency, abuse, and neglect, and gives civil legal advice to all county entities, the highway department, the register of deeds, the treasurer, the county commissioner. And so leadership is important. And there is a mess that was in the state's attorney's office and continues to be there and needs to be cleaned up.
Where do you begin? And why are you the right person to do that? Yeah.
No, and thank you. And you went through a little bit of my biography, and so I'm not going to reiterate my experience and jury trials and all those kind of things. But here's where it begins. It is a public office that needs to be transparent. When you are the state's attorney, you spend a lot of time talking to judges and juries. Your credibility is crucial for the system to work effectively. And really, there's only three requirements to run for Minnehaha County State's Attorney. You need a law degree, you need to be licensed to practice law in South Dakota, and you need to be a Minnehaha County resident. So when you talk about what do you need to do to clean up the office, well, the first thing we need to do is look at the present situation. There are three candidates running for State's Attorney. I am the only one that actually lives in Minnehaha County. One of the candidates has lived in a house near Lenox that she owns for the last 11 years. The other candidate has a house in southern Lincoln County where he's lived for the last 7 years with his family. It is unfortunate because when we fill out a nominating petition for this job, we have to list our principal residence in Minnehaha County and sign a declaration before a notary that we're eligible to seek the office. One of the candidates has listed her brother's address, and the other candidate has listed an address of, I assume, his buddy on Southwestern Avenue. And so if you're going to clean up the office, the first thing you need to do is get the two ineligible candidates who don't live in Minnehaha County to admit that they don't live in Minnehaha County and that their declaration was false. You know, I actually went to the house where one of the candidates claims to live last night on Southwestern. And when I was there, I met with the tenant at that residence who said that she did not know the candidate who claims to live there, but she's sick of getting his mail because when you list a residence for candidacy, you get all sorts of flyers and those kind of things for different political products. And so the candidate or the individual I talked to last night not only agreed to put up my sign in her yard, but said, I've been trying to tell this candidate to quit getting mail at this residence because I don't want it anymore. And that candidate won't forward it to his actual residence.
So
I apologize. I know I sound very passionate about this, but I just.
Right. And it's certainly not something that, yeah. It's certainly not something I can fact check here on the air. So, but are you saying, you know, qualifications of where you live is, you're leading with that because you believe there's an integrity issue here or a character issue that certainly was, you know, we saw that with Aaron McGowan. There are many questions about his behavior. And is that why that would be the first thing that you would answer would be about, you know, residents? Because you feel that this is a character assessment that people need to understand. Do I understand you right?
If you're able to, thank you. If you're able to or willing to give a false address to seek a job and defraud voters by doing so, then how can we trust you to clean up the office and to make sure that the office is running efficiently? And again, I apologize, and I know I'm passionate about this, but it's just very frustrating to me when people can't be honest about where they're living.
So tell us a little bit about how your experience intersects with this leadership role as well. And, you know, what from private practice, from public practice, you know, from criminal and civil law, from trial work, what do you think that is particularly pertinent to leadership of this office and these attorneys, especially who, you know, who'll be working for you? What do you pull from your past that you think will be particularly important for this job?
Yeah, no, and thank you for asking that. There's 30 lawyers currently in the state's attorney's office. 26 of them primarily do criminal prosecutions. 4 of them are involved in civil work. I have the most jury trials of any candidate for the position. I've been a prosecutor for 15 of the 28 years that I've been a lawyer. And I also have a lot of civil experience. I've been in private practice. As you pointed out, for the last 9.5 years, I've been an assistant city attorney for Sioux Falls. And I'm the only candidate with any significant civil experience. When I left the state's attorney's office in 2010, there was one civil attorney. There's currently 4, which shows how much that role has expanded. And based upon my experience, I believe I can lead that office and mentor the lawyers and staff that are there.
Paul Bengford, candidate for Minnehaha County State's Attorney, any final thoughts before I let you go?
Well, the final thought that I have is I will clean up the mess in the state's attorney's office, but I need the help of Republican voters on June 2nd to make sure the mess doesn't continue. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Our next candidate is Daniel Hager. He served as a senior deputy for the Public Defender's Office in Minnehaha County and as a deputy state's attorney in Lincoln County. Now an assistant city attorney for Sioux Falls, where he manages the Human Relations Division and is the city's ADA coordinator. And he joins us now on the phone. Daniel, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Paul Bengford mentioned some concerns about where you live, and I'm going to let you address those in just a minute, but I want to start with the same question that I asked him, which is really a question about leadership, because Interim State's Attorney Crystal Johnson answered this question yesterday as well. When we look at what happened with Aaron McGowan and just sort of the public scrutiny of the Minnehaha County State's Attorney's Office, the person who takes his place permanently after this election has some work to do to rebuild public trust and confidence in the office itself. Tell us why you might be the right candidate to do that kind of job.
Yeah, and I appreciate that question. I think when you look at the position, it's important to remember that it is, you know, it's an elected position. It's public service, you know, transparency, accountability, communication. Those are things that I will value. It's things that you owe to the voters. And so when you're serving in that role, you need to remember that as we seek justice as a state's attorney's office, you know, how do we make sure that we're bringing the community along with us and, you know, working hard to keep their community safe and being an office that is accountable to them. And those are really things that I will value and prioritize. And I think that that's something that Minnehaha County wants and deserves.
You would be leading, were you elected, in a time of crisis, in a time of the pandemic, and we've talked about increasing and, you know, failure to appear cases. There are challenges of keeping people safe while protecting public safety. Talk a little bit about crisis leadership and what the confidence that people will need to have to know those things are going forward, because that's those are essential services. They can't just stop because of a contagion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, COVID has certainly opened, you know, everyone's eyes to how do we do things? How do we keep important services going, you know, in times of crisis? You're absolutely right. the Human Relations Division with the City of Sioux Falls, one of our primary objectives is to investigate discrimination claims, you know, in employment, housing, various areas. And so that discrimination doesn't necessarily stop just because of a virus outbreak. And so I've been managing this division, and we've made sure that our services are still taking place. We're looking for creative ways to investigate those cases, creative ways to even simply get a signature, you know, from an individual on a document that we need. That's the same type of innovation that we're going to need to have in any business, and certainly in the state's attorney's office. You know, I think they've looked for ways to make sure that they continue to prosecute cases. They talk about the, you know, the failure to appear that are coming. You know, that's a reality. Trying to get those individuals to turn themselves in and help alleviate some of that sheriff's burden serving those warrants. It's you're going to have to be nimble, and I think I can bring that. I've always embraced technology, even when I was working in Lincoln County prosecuting. We had switched to a digital case management system that would help us provide discovery faster and more efficiently. That's the type of changes that I would look to bring to that office. Just make sure that we're serving Minnehaha County in a way that is, you know, flexible, and also make sure that we're doing our work even when there are roadblocks that, you know, the world throws at you.
Candidate Paul Bangford said that he is the only candidate of the three of you who actually lives in Minnehaha County, which he said is a requirement. He mentioned visiting a house that someone gets your mail, and had some character issues there. I want to make sure we give you enough time to respond to that. It's a pretty direct statement about your character and where you live. So, first of all, where do you live?
Sure. Let me say this. I think that South Dakota voters don't like negative campaigning. I think they deserve better. And that can be Paul's main platform. I think he's mistaken about the law. I think the law says that you have to reside in Minnehaha County to hold the position. Certainly, I intend on complying with the law. I think that I've run a campaign that is focused on ideas and issues. I'm going to continue to do that. At the end of the day, I'm going to be proud of that campaign. I think that my supporters will be as well.
So do you live in Minnehaha County? Are you going to relocate to Minnehaha County? Is that part of the law as you interpret it, or do you not have to relocate? Help us figure out the details of that.
I would relocate to Minnehaha County.
If you win.
Yes.
You have worked as a public defender and a state's attorney. Tell us a little bit about the differences between the skills that you bring to each one of those roles.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, they're both criminal law. They're very different. My time serving as a senior deputy public defender really helped me grow and see just the personal side that the decisions coming from the state's attorney's office can have on an individual level. You know, you can see the impact that that has on what are community members of Minnehaha County. I think that that helped me become a better prosecutor. You know, certainly the prosecutor has a lot of power and a lot of decision-making power. And so just to remember to not make decisions, you know, based on anger, but justice, and to say, okay, you know, this is what is good for the community. This is what is good for the victims. This is what's justice for the defendant. And so I think that that broader scope and that that broader understanding has really set me up to serve as state's attorney and make sure that justice is done, because ultimately that's what that office needs to do. And, you know, that's the main requirement.
Before I let you go, Daniel, any final thoughts for voters who are heading into the primary on Tuesday?
Well, I would just ask for their vote. Again, I think that my background has shown one of service, integrity, and accountability, and that's what I would bring to that office. I look forward to Tuesday. Thank you.
Minnehaha County Interim State's Attorney Crystal Johnson, who you heard from before, did respond to Paul Bangford's comments by telling SDPB, "I do reside in Minnehaha County. I am a renter. He is accurate that I don't pay property tax in Minnehaha County, but I do live here," end quote. Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.